Hi, and welcome to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan. This is a show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. But today, we're going to be taking a look at the week that was. We're going to go from the tragic death of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi to the question of the color of your socks. Quite a wide range set of stories we have for you today. And to help me out, we have Gayathri Venkateswaran. She is an assistant professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia, and also Abdurrahman Koya, who is an editor with Free Malaysia Today. Thank you so much for joining me. Okay, we're going to start on a very somber note, and that's Jamal Khashoggi's death. And maybe to give a sense of why this is so important is that he is just one of many who have died this year. Journalists, according to Reporters Without Borders, 57 journalists have been killed this year. 10 citizen journalists have been killed and four media assistants. That's a huge number. We're not at the end of 2018 yet. But Jamal Khashoggi's death is special in many ways. Gaya, tell me what were your thoughts when this story first unfolded?
Yeah, I mean, definitely this is, there's been an increase actually in threats against journalists worldwide. And we do know that in the case of Saudi, there's also been the kind of crackdown against activists or those, raising their viewpoints. Bloggers, for example, I think the case of Raif Badawi is one of them, writer, blogger. So I think when the incident first happened, I think it really took us all by, it's really shocking because, something has happened actually at an embassy. The embassy in Turkey, and coming or involving someone who's actually been also questioning and being very critical about the Saudi government and talks about reforms, for example, calling for international attention to look at what is happening in the country. For someone who's worked with groups on safety of journalists, I think that, one death is always one too many, yeah? It just points out to the sort of really precarious situation that a lot of journalists put themselves in because they want to report what the truth is.
Okay, before I get your views on this, Rahman, I just want to ask you to listen to Khashoggi himself. This is him speaking about the kind of possibilities that are afforded journalists who speak from Washington, D.C., outside his own country, but also speaking to a Saudi audience.
Don't want to listen to somebody who would disappoint them with bad news. But here in Washington, we can discuss the bad news and probably it will find its way through the ears of the Saudis.
Okay, that was Jamal Khashoggi speaking in his own voice about how he views the kind of dynamics that are afforded to journalists from the Middle East. What do you think when you first heard it, Rahman? What was your first thoughts? Because it started out as a disappearance. It only became a murder later on.
I think it is something shocking, but it's not surprising because I think we all know the history of contemporary Middle East and the so-called Arab Spring that came about and all that. And I don't think there has been any reform as far as media is concerned in the Arab world. So I think what happened to Khashoggi is an eye-opener, at least, to those who defend the Arab governments in the West, for example. And I think it was a long time coming. It's something that puts into perspective the kind of freedom that the Arab journalists enjoy in doing their work.
Well, the Washington Post post his death did in fact publish his piece. It's called "What the Arab World Needs Most is Free Expression." Did you read that piece?
Yes, yes, indeed.
What were your main takeaways from that opinion piece?
So, I mean, in that piece, he actually talks about how Saudi Arabia actually factors in or ranks. Against some of the other countries, Jordan, Lebanon having much better freedoms. But he does say that, this promise of this Arab Spring did not really spread everywhere else because of the prevailing political struggles and also the repression that's happening. And I think he wanted to draw attention back to what is happening in the region to say, maybe there was too much of softening in approach to this narrative that was being brought by Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS. And that maybe we are missing some of the other key issues in terms of fundamental rights, right?
And yeah, and also, you know, Thomas Friedman gets pilloried, yeah. I think, again and again, and this time because of the way in which he functions as a Western journalist, a high-profile Western journalist, who does basically public relations for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Yeah. The question is, when we look at ourselves, how have we covered the events in the Middle East, and how have, you know, has the Malaysian media itself dealt with the prickly issue of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, considering the diplomatic ties between our countries?
I think our coverage of the situation in Arabia or in the Middle East shows that we are always talking about government-to-government relationship. That's our priority. It's always the case here. And I think I don't see any way how we can compare our coverage to the kind of debate that's going on in the rest of the Arab world.
If I can just comment on that, I think also our coverage of the Middle East is vis-a-vis the Western media, right? I think we rely so much also on the coverage that's from there, which is why I think we get carried away with some of this, the ways in which, you know, it's presented.
So, the news agenda is actually being set in the West because we don't have an independent take on what's happening there.
Yeah, so I guess that's where Al Jazeera were coming up, was meant to be, you know, to provide the different perspective and views. Mm-hmm. But I think largely we are still dependent on what are basically filtered and sometimes manufactured content.
Which is also the case with all the other world affairs that we are covering, you know, because we don't really have our own perspectives on issues, and we are always dependent on the wires, on Reuters, on AFP, on all the big media, CNN, Al Jazeera. Of course, Al Jazeera comes in as to set a kind of balance when it comes to the happenings in the Arab world. For example, when there was the fallout between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, so we get another perspective because the presence of Al Jazeera there.
Okay, this is actually a very big topic. We're going to take a short break now. We're going to come back with a look at the colour of your socks. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. My guests in the studio today are Gayathri Venkateswaran. She is an assistant professor with the University of Nottingham, Malaysia, that's in Semenanjung, and Abdulrahman Koya, who is the editor with Free Malaysia Today. We were talking about the death of Jamal Khashoggi and the implications of that, the various dimensions to it. I just want you to hear this. This is Khalil Jashan. He's the executive director of the Arab Center in Washington, D.C.
Jamal was not a dissident or opposition, as people in the media keep describing him. Jamal was a, you know, loyal, normal Saudi citizen. He was his main sin is that he was bright, he was a maverick, and he was outspoken. He couldn't hold things back.
That was Khalil Jashan, who is the executive director of the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., speaking about his friend Jamal Khashoggi. Coming back to the real complexity of the stories, we noted that there's a worldwide trend of killing journalists and people working in the media, with already 57 journalists killed this year, according to Reporters Without Borders. But there are specific nuances, and part of that is the fact that the murder happened in Turkey and who Jamal is in the dynamics of the Middle East today.
So actually, again, you know, we talked about where our perspectives are when it comes to reporting about, say, the investigations or some of the expectations of what had happened. It's the Turkish media that largely is pro-government, yeah? Because following the 2016 sort of attempted coup, President Erdogan actually, you know, it was a crackdown on independent media and critical media. So there's, I think, more than 100 media outlets that were shut down. A lot of journalists are behind bars. So even the reporting about what's been happening around this case is also somewhat through what I think is pro-government media and whether they are possible agenda, because that is indeed one of the questions that's being asked, if we can rely on that information, actually.
Yeah. You know, so the media, you know, always striving to be independent and bring you the truth, but always also caught up in the realities of political dynamics. And here too in Malaysia, the education minister, Mazli Malik, has complained. He complained recently that he spoke about many things. He did mention socks, and that got played up by Utusan Malaysia. Do you blame the politician? Do you blame the newspapers and the editors for kind of angling it in the way they want?
I think we can't blame the media, because you see, we always pick the things that society wants to hear. Like, for example, if he's talking about some serious stuff for like 30 minutes and there is like 1 or 2 minutes where he spoke about socks, so for example, I mean, let's face it, a lot of parents out there, they want to know what is it all about. So they tweet on it and they go to the social media and they talk about it. And eventually it becomes news. So we have the responsibility to report it, you know, to say that there is some kind of response that is being generated from
that comment. So even if he characterizes it as a trivial comment, it did in fact get traction. And this is the same thing with the black shoes issue. It really did gain traction. Again, he complained then that it was just a minor suggestion in a slew of things. What do you think it's about the minister not having a well thought through communication strategy, not understanding how the media operates?
Well, I think if you take the sort of news cycle that we have, right, we have a 24-hour news cycle, everyone wants information like that. People are tweeting information also from the meetings that they are attending. So when you think about where people are getting, you know, how do they find out about all of this? It's not just from the media, it's also having, you know, direct access, right? So like the case of the shoes, I think you don't understand the implication of your comments because you didn't think through. You were probably joking, or you were probably thinking, okay, maybe we should, you know, focus on this instead. But as you know, you said, it matters a lot to parents because, and to the traders. Are they going to now, you know, get rid of all their white shoes and certain socks? Because it's a huge industry, right? And it's a burden to parents. No. So I think with what's been happening with some of the ministers, number one, to understand also that not everything that they say is going to be reported as they want it. The media do have the prerogative to choose what from there is important for them, you know? So
Okay, let's take Mazli's position, right? I mean, he's looking at a media outlet that he thinks is actually hostile in general to his government, not just him, though I think he also made the decision to cut the purchase of Utusan newspapers for the ministry. Yeah. But, I mean, that aside, I mean, Utusan is seen as aligned to UMNO, and therefore, you know, they might actually want to portray the minister as somebody of a somewhat bumbling character who focuses on the trivial. I mean, wouldn't that be fair?
I think these are the realities that our ministers have to come to terms with, because we are talking about a media which has just come out of years of being contained and, you know, being told what to do, and you cannot blame the media, because this is what happened in Indonesia. Because, you know, there is a Malay saying that it's like kera dapat bunga or something. Mm. So we are in that stage now, although we are not as free as...
So I'm trying to think of the metaphor here. So the monkey gets the flower, doesn't know what to do with it, probably eats it or rips it apart.
Yeah. Ah,
okay.
Yeah.
So should the minister, Guy, in your own, you know, thinking about this, just ignore this and just say, well, okay, that's Utusan. Utusan is going to play this up, and he shouldn't be so sensitive about the different ways in which his message is being put out.
I actually think that there's some level of unfairness also from this Pakatan government, because they have, you know, they have been targeted by some of the media owned by the previous government or closely tied to them. You know, Utusan definitely, Media Prima, The Star. But, you know, you have to rise above that kind of political divides and baggage and say, look, this, if this is your new government, your approach, which is going to be different, you have to say, well, my duty is to give the information, and I have to be transparent. I have to be transparent and allow all the media to come in, because they also have a tendency to say, oh, I don't want this media coming in for this briefing and stuff like that. It happens, right? But your accountability is to your to the ministry, to the media. You have to let the media pick and choose, because over time, I think audiences will also say, look, this, we don't want this kind of information. And I think we need to have and allow for that process to take place. But for the ministers, they have to be accountable. So they cannot pick and choose, you know?
I think eventually there will be the serious debate will come out of it after all the, you know, trying to grasp what the minister is saying and all that. Eventually the debate will come out. And I think the minister cannot have a say on that, because ultimately the angle, the news angle, is determined by the media according to their needs.
Right. So in some ways, the Pakatan Harapan, having ushered this new era of freedom and an unshackled media, will have to deal with a varied landscape, much of it not in its favour, or some of it at least not in its favour. Okay, I'm speaking to Abdulrahman Koya, editor with Free Malaysia Today, and also Gayathri Venkateswaran. She's an assistant professor with the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. We'll focus on the media, the stories of the week, as well as some dynamics in the media that we should be focused on. My guest today, Abdulrahman Koya, he's an editor with Free Malaysia Today, and also Gayathri Venkateswaran with University of Nottingham, Malaysia, out in Semenye. Yes, Semenye. It's a lovely part of the country. Okay. Now, Khazanah Research Institute published its State of Households report. It was an amazing kind of survey of where the Malaysian household is and some other dynamics. One of them was the kind of disappearing presence of women in the workforce over time. Guy, does this affect the media at all? I mean, is there a media dimension in this?
Yeah, so Semenye is relevant because, you know, it precisely addresses the kind of gaps that exist between the different regions, and that was really highlighted within the report. But what I really found interesting was the use of this concept, disappearing women, which to me really, it feels a bit depressing, but it actually demonstrates a reality. And the title is about the realities, right? Live realities. Where what they found was that you've had far more women who are educated entering the workforce. But as age, as they get into their 30s and 40s, many begin to drop out of the workforce. And for at least about 60% of them, the reason for coming out of the workforce is the family obligations. So whereas men cite family obligations, maybe out of, you know, the numbers are so low, for them it is because of education levels or other challenges. So as age goes on, and where you're becoming at the peak of your sort of careers and your expertise, women are out of that sphere. And so by the time you look at, say, decision-making roles, so there are far fewer women because the pool has already reduced by then. And so the report cites this and uses this to describe the challenges facing women, that yes, a lot more women are out there in the workforce, they have far more opportunities, but this is a phenomenon that is actually quite worrying.
Okay. Yeah. Abdulrahman, do you see that refracted through the media? I mean, is there something in the media in terms of journalists, for instance, or people who reach positions of editorial leadership?
Well, definitely. I think the media is really affected by the problems of disappearing women, as you put it, you know, because I think one of the uniqueness of working in the media, especially in the new media, is that we can work from anywhere, whether in the house or, you know, and it is like a 24-hour shift. So the fact that we are losing this big section of media practitioners, it's really worrying.
How do you think it shapes editorial policy or editorial direction? Because I think one of the things that we've learned over time, one of the best practices to have when it comes to putting together a newsroom is to keep it diverse. Mm-hmm. That your newsroom should reflect your population, your society, its diversity, you know, not just men and women or ethnic diversity, but also regional diversity. You ought to have your Sabahans and Sarawakians and people from, you know, Kelantan and Terengganu in order for that conversation to be rich and real. The disappearance of women in the newsroom, what does it do?
Well, I think, you know, at first glance, a lot of people will conclude that there's a lot of women in the media. And I think that's not entirely wrong. But where the women are sort of placed, the kinds of roles that they fulfill, the report does say that a lot more women are in what you would say the feminine sectors, right, the services. And also many women journalists and editors have experiences where, you know, the assignments that they get are very different from their male counterparts. It doesn't mean that all of them have the same experience, but the tendency for that to happen. So how many newsrooms actually have policies regarding the kind of diversity? How many newsrooms say we have to aim for 30% at the decision-making role? Media that's actually public listed also don't even fill that basic minimum quota in that sense, right? And then how many of them have, say, sexual harassment policies in-house? There's been a recent survey by Institute of Journalists Malaysia saying that at times you can see women earn more than the men at certain levels.
But it sort of plateaus.
Yeah, but then also the question is, what are the roles that the women fulfill there? Are they on the field or are they desk bound, right? So a lot of questions, but I think it's really relevant.
Okay, do you see it though? I know of women journalists in Malaysia who buck the trend, right? Who cover war, for instance. War correspondents are typically male. It's seen as a province of male kind of led journalism, the bravado, the danger, the whatever. But we've had women, Malaysian women journalists covering that. But largely, you know, Abraham, do you see that women in journalism are kind of confined to those feminine, so-called feminine roles?
I don't think so, because I think at least when I'm speaking on, based on my experience, is that the more women are confined to their household roles, for example, the more work they could do for journalists, desk-bound journalism. And desk-bound journalism is actually, there's more power than, for example, a journalist who is going out there on the field. Because when you are desk-bound, you tend to make decisions and the way you angle a certain report and all that. So I think a lot more women are in a more senior level when it comes to journalism, just because perhaps their family life makes them confined to that.
To the office.
What
about the fact that we have different, you know, language media, and is that issue taken up in different ways?
It's not, and I think it has to be, because I think you can see also what happens within the different language communities. Also the impact of culture and the kind of upbringing and expectations of the roles. The gender roles are a lot more obvious when you're looking at some media compared to the other language media. And I think that, you know, research has shown definitely that when you overlaid with religion and cultural practices, the lack of opportunities to also even question your seniors, sexual harassment. If you take what's been happening in India with the Me Too cases, right? These are prevailing challenges for some of the language communities.
How does Free Malaysia today deal with those issues? I mean, are you conscious about achieving some sort of gender parity in the workforce and management and editorial leadership?
Well, I can tell you that we don't have time to even think of quota and, you know, gender parity and all that. But it's something that comes naturally, I think, with the kind of news that we do to cater to all levels of society, whether it's women issues or political issues, or, you know, and there comes a time when every one of us has to be equipped with that knowledge, and it doesn't matter whether you're a woman or man, you should be able to write about issues objectively. So I think the question of whether there should be a woman, male-female balance in the newsroom, I don't think it's a big problem yet. I don't think that's a problem yet.
Do you see that? Do you see it similar to?
No, I think, see, that's why I think, because numbers are not enough, right? I mean, like, That's why I say you can, you almost get a sense that there's a lot more women in the media. And so the question is like, why are we complaining? But I think that when you break it down and talk about maybe the kind of the newsroom settings, I mean, for the longest time, your best stories or the scoops are from the pubs or from drinking buddies and things like that, right? Or in environments where you get scoops because you're able to go and smoke out together. I mean, this is the reality, right? This is the reality. You have, we've heard of female journalists who, for the scoop stories, have to, you know, go up to the hotel room of somebody to get. So there are real cases. Right. So I think it has to go beyond numbers. And there has to be, because if we leave it naturally, that's why we get reports still like this.
Okay, yeah, we're going to have an answer. We're going to come back. We're going to come back. We're going to come back and pick up on some other dimensions of the Karazana Research Institute State of Households report. Stay tuned. Let's talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin, my guest today, Gayathri Venkateswaran. She is an assistant professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia, out in Semenanjung, and also Abdurrahman Koya, who's with Free Malaysia Today. And I don't know exactly where Free Malaysia Today has its offices, otherwise I would mention it as well as I did Semenanjung. You were about to say something when we took a break.
What was it?
I was just saying the numbers are not enough. Yeah, and that it cannot be allowed to be natural processes.
Okay. Well, maybe we can move on from the question of disappearing women to the question of how economics and complex economic issues are telegraphed in the news and the media. Karazana Research Institute State of Households report, Gaia, you said, actually was dealt with by different media in very different ways. They focus on different things. And can you tell us a little bit of what you sensed from looking across the media?
So there are several parts to the report. So you have the sort of overall income levels within the households. You also had a regional look, so to say that how different states, how it played out in different states, so the kind of regional differences. And then you had a whole section on women in the workforce. And then there was one on migrant workers. So I think the one that was least covered was the one about the migrant workers. The one that had, I believe, a lot of focus was the gap between the top 20 and then the B40s. So that gap, discussions about the Gini coefficient being insufficient as an indicator, because that doesn't tell the whole story, because the actual, the differences are much bigger. I think the regional part of it, you know, how the different states fared, that was actually, like, that featured quite a lot. I noticed that the English media took an interest in the women in the workforce more than the others, for example.
So all media having its different focus, some of it going down linguistic lines or kind of community lines, what the editors think would be of interest to its readers. How did Free Malaysia Today cover it?
I think it's always a challenge to cover economic issues, especially when it comes to data and survey reports and all that. But I think we always have to take the angle of what is it is there something that the people want to know about from that report? For example, I mean, naturally, issues like salary and, you know,
this is also one of my kind of chief concerns, is that if you, when you put on your editorial hat and you say, what do ordinary people want to know, you always end up on the same issues, almost always. It's going to be wages, it's going to be, you know, cost of living, and so on and so forth, right? Which are not unimportant issues, but they don't tell the whole story. Especially they don't tell the story about the complex trade-offs that governments have to make when they decide on policy. And we had that in the midterm review of the 11th Malaysia Plan. Also a very complex economic story. Have you looked at how the media has covered that? Because we've got the Karazana Research Report. Yeah. We have RMK 11. And we're going to come up to the budget soon. Yeah. So economics is a big story, but are we covering it adequately?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, okay, I think there's coverage on it. I think everyone has picked out, again, what they see as, you know, relevant to their audiences and to their readers. I think we have to give credit, due credit to the media, year in and year out. the reports are there, it is put out, but the question of whether people are able to digest that information and what it means to them. But there's another dimension to it. Every year we've had the Auditor General's report as well. And I think one of the kind of skepticism of audiences is you put out all this information, but what has happened with that, right? So I think people are also trying to ask, so we know all of these things, and then what? Yeah. So maybe the and then what needs to be pursued by the journalists as well? What, where do we go from here? So we have all this information now. What is the next sort of maybe logical follow-up that can make sense to the reader?
Right. So the guy was a practicing journalist. You're now kind of academic and you're doing the surveys. You're kind of looking at it from above. You have to do the daily grind. I mean, does the media even have the time or resources to assimilate so much information before it even begins to think about how to redistribute it, repackage it, or reframe it for its audience?
No, we don't have much time. Let me be clear about that. But I think... what we do is to translate those things into layman's term, and to allow a certain kind of debate, and we follow it up with the experts in that field. So I think the midterm review on Thursday was interesting because it was the first time that a new government is, you know, the public is expecting the policy layout of the new government, and it was more or less something like an anticlimax because a lot of people are looking forward to a lot of new policies, and basically it's like a repetition of the manifesto and all that. But
So public may be impatient to, but I do see the difficulties for the government. I am not an economist. I'm not trained in that, so I too have difficulties trying to understand what all this and how it all fits together. My fear is that it's being simplified. That the media, in having to turn pages of text into graphics, for instance, you know, invariably simplifies something that's far too complex.
But then again, this is what is happening with all the other issues, right? Like it's not only economics, but
foreign affairs.
Foreign affairs, for example. Yeah.
But I think you know, it's a question also of, I think, for the media to, because they are rushing to put things out. There is the question of how much it costs, in fact, to invest in all of these things. But I think, you know, again, I don't think we should be too cynical also of the media, because you know, I've been in parliament where they released the budget and the OPP's outline perspective plan and the Malaysian plans. They have been briefings, and the purpose is to say, you know, this is what it is, because it's, you know, sets of volumes, right? And so there is time to digest some of it. And so you have different media having your different audiences. You pick the ones that are relevant. But these are information that's actually available to the public also who want it. Some responsibility also needs to go back to the individuals to say, if I want it, I have to also get that. But I also note that there was some issue with media briefing when some media outlets were prevented from attending it. And so, you know, you're also then blocking that kind of process to you know.
Right. In fact, some other media were didn't get the embargoed copy of, say, the
midterm. They couldn't attend the briefing that Dr. Shazmin was doing. Actually.
Right. So your wish list as an editor, Abdurrahman, what would you want? More time, more resources, work for a weekly, for instance? Would that help you?
I think if you're talking about covering complex issues, I think we need the ministers to be more open to journalists who want to get their views on certain things. And as far as the current government is concerned, I don't think they score highly in that aspect, because it's always a struggle to get them to say out things. And I think mainly because there's a kind of wilderness when it comes to policies. A lot of people don't know where they stand. What are their policies about education, for example, economics, and, you know, all we hear is that we are in a new Malaysia and, you know, people are being charged. But as far as policy is concerned, there's always the, you know, the vacuum there. Nobody knows what's happening.
I think it's not a truly Malaysian problem at this point in time. We're going to be back with a look at resources and time with regard to investigative journalism. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. My guest today, Gayathri Venkateswaran. She's assistant professor at the University of Nottingham in Malaysia, on Semenanjung to be precise, geographically speaking. We also have Abdulrahman Koya, who is editor with Free Malaysia Today. We're talking about the kind of resources that media has to deal with, you know, what often are mountains, volumes of information on the economy and how difficult that is. It goes back to a very important issue. I think coming out of the 1MDB scandal, the publication of, you know, the billion-dollar whale and the story of how that took 3 years of serious investigative journalism to produce, and it, of course, had incredible impact on Malaysian politics to boot. The question is, your organization, Free Malaysia Today, do you put resources behind investigative journalism as opposed to the daily reporting and analysis that you do?
I think the key issue about investigative journalism is resources, because you need a lot of money to invest in a lot of things that you need in order to make that investigation happen.
Is that something that you actually have? I mean, you know, you were a journalist, and at that point, the media organizations you worked with, did it actually have opportunities to do investigative work?
Well, I think, I mean, definitely resources is a key issue, because you need to spend time. You need to have your reporters away from the daily routine and you know, doing the kind of groundwork. But one of the things that I feel that is less costly that can be done, but it also requires a much more open regime, is that information needs to be out a lot more regularly, coming especially from the public officials, right? Official information. So the fact that we are, you know, we have certain points in a year where everyone is gathered to get information. So it's the budget, it's the Auditor General's report, we wait for that.
But now the Auditor General report comes out in three parts, doesn't it? Doesn't it help?
Well, I mean, but it's still the Auditor General's report. What I'm saying is the monopoly should be broken down and allow for bureaucrats who are actually doing the groundwork to speak to the media. The media should not have to wait for ministers, who then bungle up sometimes because it's not their expertise. I mean, they are ministers, but they don't necessarily know everything about the issue. You have the bureaucrats working there, not to put them in a spot, but they are the ones working on it. And I think that more regular briefings will really help some of the work that is needed to do part of this investigative journalism. So to me, that's costless, because it is about a culture of giving out information rather than, you know.
Okay, but coming back to the question of investigative journalism, you know, Abdulrahman, we've had 5 months since May 9th and the general election. Do you think the media really is going to rethink its own strategies and, you know, and redistribute its resources so that, because 1MDB happened in the past, it doesn't mean it can't happen in the future.
I think when you talk about resources, you're talking about, I didn't get your question.
Yeah. So the question is, do you see the media kind of coming to a realization that needs to put resources behind investigative journalism?
Yes, I think as I said, revenue is very important when we are talking about investigative journalism, and that is something that the traditional media were enjoying once, and yet the alternative media, those online like us, despite the huge traffic, we failed to get that kind of advertising revenue and all that. But I think since the May 9 elections, there is a greater challenge of investigative journalism, because we are more open, and we have no excuse to say that we have no, you know, we have no excuse to say that we cannot embark on something freely.
So right, okay, so here we have the conundrum, right? The media is, on one hand, the fourth estate, it's got all these lofty ideals to deliver on in terms of an open society, but also it's a commercial enterprise, at least, well, the private sector of it, right? Not the public sector, but the private. And so, but how do you make it work? You could do great investigative journalism, it doesn't necessarily improve your revenue.
Sure.
It might, you know, make you more visible, it might improve your brand standing, but it doesn't translate into greater revenue.
Sure. And you know, I mean, definitely that's a struggle that everyone is facing in a lot of societies, because it's an important aspect of journalism. You need that. But a lot of people, a lot of editors will say, but that's not the one that the readers are interested in. They want to read the scandals, they want to read the conspiracy theories. That's fine, it's there, But it should be available also for those who are interested in long-form read, in-depth investigation. And I think there are ways that people are, at least journalists around the world, are considering now, and that is to work in collaboration. So it's not, you know, solely the, you know, just within one outlet, but if you have public interest issues, and often these kinds of issues are cross borders.
Right, so we think like the consortium of investigative journalists worked on the Panama Papers, right?
So we're talking about more collaborative initiative. Of course, you'll always have your rivals, but that's, you know, that's, you have to have that, because what else keeps the sort of, you know, the oomph there? But there, it is possible to have some form of collaboration between some of the media outlets. And I think, you know, it's been done in before for other areas. It is possible. So one way is to say, look, we are going to devote some attention here, but work together with maybe other kinds of organizations and shared costs, while the others are doing the routine, bringing in the ads and things like that.
I think what's happening now is a lot of media do a lot of duplicate things, you know, like they like when it comes to covering something, day-to-day press conferences, we do that, and all of us want to compete on that, you know. So
covering the reports. I do want to say, I mean, I did a little Twitter poll, and I asked if there was a pot of money, where would you give your money to? And single mothers and student loans were highly rated. I mean, this is not a scientific study by any means, but grants to the arts and grants to investigative journalism rated about 11% each, right? I mean, do you think the public has not understood the immense importance of investigative journalism in this century?
I think the public is not really interested about journalism per se as a field, because they are news consumers, and I have this feeling that at least I gather that, you know, whenever we talk about journalism, press freedom and all that, it doesn't really resonate well with the public. And because I think people still think that's your line of work and that's nothing to do with me. You see, I just want your news. I don't want to know about the news.
Very quickly, what's your take on this? Yeah. Do you think the public is indifferent?
Well, I think, you know, it's like we don't have to say to them, this is investigative journalism, this is press freedom. You give the story, right? The story speaks for itself. And, you know, why were people rushing to get Billion Dollar Whale and, you know, all these other stories? Because there is an interest. So you don't have to package it in that way. It is about telling that story. And I think people still want to listen to stories. They still want to read narratives, really.
Okay, thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Gayathri Venkateswaran. She is an assistant professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia, and also Abdurrahman Koya, who's editor at Free Malaysia Today. They've been very, you know, they've been very kind to me and joining me today, Saturday night, to look back at the week and see what we can glean from the stories of the week. Remember, we're going to be here every night at 10 p.m. Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan, only on Astro One.